This talk was given at Insight Meditation South Bay. For more information and a schedule of our events, visit the Insight Meditation South Bay website at www.imsb.org. For information about online programs, visit the Bodhi Courses website at www.bodhicourses.org. Bodhi is spelled B-O-D-H-I.
So let's just take a moment to arrive fully. If you haven't already, maybe unplugging and letting go of anything that you've been doing before right now. Bringing awareness to the body, the breath. And then as you're ready, opening out to our group, our circle, our Zoom circle. I'm delighted to be here this evening. I'm gonna tell you a little bit about how I envision our time together going tonight, and then we'll dive in. I do wanna offer you an introduction since most of you I don't know. And then I'll be giving a little bit of a talk, and I'm really hoping that it can be interactive. There'll be an opportunity for a breakout room that's likely, but it's not required. So if you're not up for a breakout room, you just don't accept the invitation, and you can do the reflection on your own, whatever works for you. And then after that, we'll have a sit, about a 30-minute sit, and then a little time to check in after that. So I'm a longtime student of habits, like my lifetime. I'm a recovering type A, I like to say. Do you remember that old type A category? People that are really driven, perfectionistic, easy to get angry, short-tempered. Anybody relate to that? It's a good recipe for suffering, right? Yeah. Well, by the time I was in my mid-30s, I had chronic back pain and GI problems that required medication. I was working in a hospital in New Jersey, and sometimes it was life or death, but it was really taking a toll on me, and that's what brought me to meditation. And I took on yoga and meditation seriously at that time as a way to improve my health. And my first teacher was a Buddhist nun, American-born Buddhist nun by the name of Ani Trime. And fortunately, she was sitting right next to the hospital. It couldn't have been easier for me. So I started sitting with her around the late 90s and eventually made my way to Spirit Rock. And the benefits of the practices were so inspiring for me that I wanted to bring that into the work that I was doing, is working as a psychologist. So I started studying MBSR, went on eventually to do the training at Spirit Rock. And I always knew, I really felt that mindfulness could be helpful for people. I was specializing in eating recovery and anxiety, but I didn't really have the how. I mean, I would teach mindfulness, but how does it actually help you change? And in 2014, I met Judson Brewer, who some of you may know is a researcher and neuroscientist who's really aligned modern science with Buddhist psychology and articulated, not invented, but articulated a model, I think, that is really accessible for all of us. And it's kind of the how of how mindfulness can help us with understanding our minds and cultivating healthy habit patterns. Not get rid of all of them, but give us a way to work with, shall we say, our conditioning. So I've been working with him since 2014, and we do a lot of different work in a lot of different settings. So a lot of what I'm sharing tonight is what I learned from him. And then probably, I don't know, maybe 4 years ago, my teacher, Anna Douglas, referred me to Shyla. So I started sitting some retreats with Shyla and have really had the privilege of sitting some retreats with her and doing some online training, which I feel very, very fortunate. So I'm going to be talking tonight about how the mind works. And like I said, kind of a blend of Buddhist psychology, modern psychology, and the underpinnings in neuroscience. So tonight is going to be a broad brushstroke. I won't be going into the nitty gritty, the details. We certainly don't have time for that. But we'll be sharing some concepts, and it's really concepts in the service of wisdom. So my hope is that when we do some of the reflections, that that will help you to integrate that or bring that to your own experience to see for yourself. And even we'll bring that into the sitting as well. As many of you know, the Buddha said something like, I teach one thing and one thing only, suffering and the end of suffering. And I think that's the theme of this work, finding the end of suffering. And it just amazes me how 2,500 years ago, when they didn't have paper, they really discovered the cornerstone, the building blocks of what modern science likes to be thrilled about validating today. So I have a quote I'd like to share from Alan Marlatt, who was a pioneer in mindfulness for addictions. And I think it lines up exactly with what the Buddha said about teaching one thing and one thing only. Alan Marlatt said, attention is only one aspect of mindfulness. We're also practicing seeing things more clearly and broadening our perspective, which includes noting the ways we increase our suffering and learning ways to reduce it. So, and now a poem. How can it be that my whole life depends upon this itch? Imagine this itch is the itch to finish the whole bag, the itch to watch one more episode well past bedtime, the itch to send that reactive email, the itch to honk the horn, the itch to criticize and defend my views, the itch to leave the present moment to make plans and dream about the future, the itch to turn away from the homeless person. How could it be that this itch determines how my life unfolds? Do you have any itches? Can you relate to that itch? So in the teachings, we learn that causes and conditions contribute to our circumstances. We have choices, and then those choices lead to results. And that's really the kind of the nature of habits themselves. So I want to bring in here how habits are formed. So habits and learning really is all takes place in the same format for all beings, all the way down to the sea slug. We all learn in the same way, and we're set up for survival. And this is probably familiar to many of you, reward-based learning or operant conditioning. There's a trigger or something that happens, could be internal or external. There's a behavior, something that we do or don't do. And there's a reward for that. And when I say reward, I'm referring to brain speak. So for our ancestors, it was all about survival. They were hungry. They had to hunt. And then they ate, and that was the reward. Or maybe if there was danger, they had to run away, and the reward was survival. So if we shortcut and fast forward to modern times when we don't have to hunt for food, we can see how habit loops develop in all different areas of our lives. Food is a very easy one. I try a new flavor ice cream. It lights up the dopamine in my brain. It tastes really good. And the next time I see ice cream, even if I'm not hungry, I have craving for that ice cream. Or maybe I feel bad and I remember, I might have some ice cream and I'll feel better. It happens with other things too. Maybe worry, even mental habits. I notice I'm worrying about something. I pick up my phone, I scroll my news feed, and now I'm distracted from that worry. So the trigger is the worry, the behavior, I'm scrolling my news feed. The reward is the worry is now stuffed down or pushed away, or it's just not present. We see this with Judd Brewer, the psychiatrist I work with. He says, Facebook is like crack cocaine, because what they found in research is that those likes, when you go on and see how many likes you've got on Facebook or whatever social media there is, that lights up the same pleasure centers in the brain that get lit up with drugs. Maybe not as intensively, but it's the same reward center. So this is how behaviors get set up through this habit loop: trigger, behavior, and reward. And a lot of times people think it's the trigger, they want to get rid of their triggers, that drives the behavior, but it's actually the reward that keeps the behavior in place. I also want to bring in that thoughts are mental behaviors. So maybe I do something that I feel embarrassed about, then I start that habit of beating myself up. Why did I say that? I always do this. And what could be the reward for that? Does that sound like that could be rewarding? Well, the way that the brain works is that things that are familiar are rewarding. The brain doesn't like change. It likes things that are familiar. So even something like negative thoughts about ourselves might be rewarding to the brain. So the more we judge ourselves, the more we judge ourselves even more. So modern science has demonstrated that our repeated patterns of thoughts and actions, they change our nervous system. Maybe you've heard the expression, the neurons that fire together wire together. So each time we do a behavior, each time we have a thought, those patterns get stronger. The nerves fire synapses, they connect, and those neural patterns are then strengthened and literally grow in that particular direction, making the same behavior and the same thoughts more likely in the future. The mind ponders, whatever the mind ponders upon becomes the inclination of the mind. So it just blows me away that the Buddha didn't have any kind of way to study the mind with a machine, but simply through his own observation. And he made this discovery 2,500 years ago. How the mind works. This also lines up with dependent origination. So the teaching of dependent origination is the 12 links, the wheel of samsara. And just the kind of the bottom of that wheel, if you've ever seen it, the links go craving, feeling, becoming, and birth. So if you think about it, contact is the trigger. Oh, I see the ice cream. The feeling is the pleasant, that's the vedana moving towards craving. the becoming might be the behavior as I'm eating the ice cream. And then the birth is, oh, I'm now a person that eats ice cream. Ice cream is good. I like ice cream. I go to ice cream when I feel bad. So I'm not going to go into the details of that. But for me, it's just amazing that this was all laid out. And it is the science of how the mind works. Now, the other aspect I just want to touch in about how the mind works is our capacity to go onto automatic pilot. And the Buddha, I think, referred to this as samsara, this endless wandering. They did a study at Harvard. Many of you might know this. They call it the mind wandering study. They pinged people on their phones, right? Asked them what they were doing, asked them if they were paying attention to what they were doing, and then had them rate their moods. So what percent of the time do you think people were on autopilot, checked out, not present, not paying attention to what they were doing? So anyone unmute, make a guess? If you don't already know, I know many of you probably know.
60.
60%. Do I have anything higher?
I'll go for 90%.
90%. Right. Okay. Thanks. We got one in the chat box, 90%, right? It feels like that. It feels like 90%, but they found 47% of the time with all but very few select other behaviors or that the mind was on autopilot. That's like almost half the time. We're checked out. We're not there. We're not paying attention. And we know this, right? It happens all the time when we're driving. We're not really paying attention. You're in the shower. You're doing your list of things to do. You're eating. The food is gone. Did I really taste it? Right. So that in combination with the way the brain develops habits, really to save our capacity to put our brain power on other things is kind of a perfect storm. So our minds are set up to go into this default mode or maybe even ignorance. And the more we do a behavior, the more habitual it becomes. The first step in changing a habit loop is waking up to a habit loop. So I would like to I'm just feeling this out right now. I want to take a little time in breakout groups for you to talk with one another about habit loops. So just to kick around, like what might be one of your habit loops? And you don't have to be like the most vulnerable habit loop, your most challenging habit loop, but it could be something easy like, yeah, I check my phone a lot or I watch the news a lot. And see if you can take a couple minutes in a breakout group just to map out what might be a trigger, what's the behavior, and then what's the reward of that behavior. And one hint is that the trigger is the least important element. If you know it and if it's obvious, that's great. But we don't need to spend a lot of time. Why am I doing this? Because it's the reward, whatever is rewarding to the brain, that keeps that behavior in place. So the first step in changing a habit loop, working with a habit loop is just waking up to any element of a habit loop. And that could be before you're engaging in it. Robin, before she gets up to the radio, she could, you know, as she has the thought of moving across the room, I'm moving into my habit loop. It could be then you wake up to it. It might be as you're checking your email, here I am, I'm in my habit loop. Or it could be afterwards, I was in that habit loop again. So beginning to wake up to it as it's happening. And once we wake up to the habit loop, we can shift into the next step, which is asking, what am I getting from this? What are all the things I'm getting from this? What's the brief relief? Robin described, it feels good when we get it, you know? But then what happens 5 minutes later when you're on email for 10 minutes, or maybe if you haven't gotten it? Sometimes I play with, you know, I could get an email with bad news. Do I really want bad news right now? So we're waking up to now the cause and effect relationship. And the Buddha taught that the experience of disenchantment is key, and that we can build disenchantment through an investigation of all aspects of our experience. And Joseph Goldstein, a quote from Joseph Goldstein, says that a thorough investigation of all aspects of one experience, the sort of examination that can only be accomplished by intensive insight over an extended period of time, will eventually mature into a deep understanding of the unsatisfactory nature of the conditioned world and constructed experience. So I hope some of that landed for you. It's a lot of concept. But what I think is so accessible is that we can boil it down to, in the moment, what do I get from this? And when we start to wake up, as Robin said, it takes a lot of time to the other results. And maybe Susan can start to explore, okay, it feels good to stay in bed an extra 5 minutes, but how does an extra 15 minutes, how does that feel? When we start to explore all the results, it doesn't feel so good. I mean, even your favorite food or your favorite coffee or whatever it is that feels really good to you, your favorite show, at some point, too much of it doesn't feel good anymore. So when we can feel that disenchantment, we're no longer excited to do it. It's not really that great thing. One of the examples from the suttas is, I like a lot of examples from dogs, as you know, because I am a volunteer for this rescue, and I train dogs. And it's all about the rewards with the dogs. When I first started doing this, my husband was like a little stingy with the rewards. And dog after dog, they would love me and come to me and do everything. And he finally figured it out that it's not me, it's the treats. It's the treats and the sound of the voice. And all that is rewarding and shapes behavior. So to get back to the sutta, the example is a dog. You know, one of the street dogs, this starving dog, sees a bone and he runs to get this bone. He's like really excited to get this bone, and he starts chewing on it and trying to get the taste, the flavor, the marrow out of it. But it's been lying in the streets and it's been bleached of anything, all the marrow. And the dog just lets go of the bone. I think the sutta says in disgust, just lets go. Because he knows there's nothing there. There's nothing there for him. And that's the quality of disenchantment. But it doesn't come from thinking about it from in the head. It comes from experiencing it in the body, knowing in that moment what we're going to get, what the true result is. So this is a practice to begin to tap into the embodied experience of disenchantment. How does it feel in the body? How is it in the mind? How long does the pleasure last? In Judd's study with the smokers, he said, smoke, go ahead and smoke and pay attention. How does it taste? How does it smell? Or when people were working with people in the eating program, that I was working with one person who, you know, they had one of these fancy cupcake stores. And she said, oh, you know, I sat down, I was going to eat the cupcake mindfully. And I took one bite and it tastes like plastic. So how much of the time when we're on that autopilot mode, we're not present, we're not logging the data. So I want to do a little reflection now with you, where I'll be asking a question, and you just can just notice what bubbles up in your experience. If you're writing, you can write down some notes, but we won't do a breakout for this. We'll just do it as a group reflection. So maybe sit back a little bit from your screen if that's comfortable for you. If it's helpful, you can close your eyes or take a soft downward gaze. And then bringing to mind one of these habit loops that you would like to work on. And then review in your mind, what is the behavior? So checking email, is it stress eating? Is it a worry habit loop? Is it not getting out of bed in the morning? And then just dropping in the question, what do I get from this? And notice what splashes up. And asking another question, what do I get from this? What are all the things that I get from this? The pleasant, the unpleasant, the short term, the long term. What do I get from this? How does it feel in my body? What's the quality of my mind state? What do I get from this emotionally? As best you can, being interested, curious, non-judgmental. You're a scientist gathering data. What do I get from this? What's the felt experience? What are all the results? And then letting the contemplation, letting that go, and shifting your attention back to our circle, our Zoom circle. So any discoveries or any surprises in that reflection? A microscope, it's late for me. More and more to that moment, can I really feel into what it feels like, like the dog letting go of the bone when, you know, there's nothing here for me. There's nothing here for me. There's nothing here for me. And to move it from the head and into the body, there's nothing here for me. And the other side of this is, which we're not getting to tonight, is, you know, how does it feel when you let go, when you put the Facebook down? How does that feel? Just checking in with the posture. Inviting a posture that supports wakefulness and ease. Feeling the body sitting. Aware that breathing is happening. Sounds in the environment or thoughts, letting them all be in the background. As you invite your attention to the sitting, breathing body. Choosing an anchor for your attention. It might be the breath, it might be the feeling of the body as a whole. Or perhaps a neutral or a pleasant sensation in the body. Is finding an easeful place for the attention to rest. And whenever you notice that the mind has left the body, the breath, maybe carried away by a long stream of thought, it's not a problem. It's a kind and friendly attitude. It's guiding the attention. Feeling into your chosen anchor. There's nothing to do, no place to go. Just being here now. from time to time, you might just check in and see how are you meeting whatever's arising. Is there a resistance? Is there a welcoming? Just seeing. As best you can, inviting the friendliness to whatever shows up, whatever's here. What's here now? Open. Receptive, interested. Sensing into the results of your practice. Any sense of ease or friendliness? A little bit of warmth or clarity. Maybe calm or steadiness. Just seeing what's here and soaking it in, soaking in the results of your practice. Feeling it in your body. Is there any place where you can feel a bit of ease, a softening? And seeing it in the mind. Maybe a little bit of settling. Maybe not. But whatever you're finding, the results of practice, drinking it in, maybe even taking it in a little bit with the in-breath. As if you could breathe in warmth or friendliness or ease. Stillness. And then tapping into your natural capacity for compassion, caring for others, sending out any little benefit of your practice tonight to others in your surroundings, maybe in your home or your neighborhood. Sending out a bit of ease or friendliness or calm. So as you're taking it in with the in-breath, letting it expand and then sending it out with the out-breath. Generously extending whatever benefits from your practice you've experienced, letting it ripple out. You might even extend to members of our circle tonight, those you know, those you don't know. Just a simple wish for others to know ease, warmth, knowing that while you're extending it, others might be wishing it to you. So this cultivation of heart, sending it out and receiving at the same time, breathing together, one big heart of compassion. And then if you care to, just extending these well wishes far and wide. And sending a wish for well-being and goodwill. May the benefits of our practice spread far and wide. Out to the sides, above and below, to the front and back, all directions. May all beings everywhere be free. So in the same way that we reflect, what do I get from this, from our habits, we can also reflect on what do I get from my practice? What do I get from wholesome action, skillful action? And really take that in. So I'm just wondering what that was like. Did you notice what were the benefits of practice? How was it to cultivate the benefits? Even if it's just that I sat today, if it, my mind was a storm of thoughts and judgments and feelings, I still have some contentment in knowing that I did sit. But most of the time, there's a little bit more, at least, in terms of stillness or clarity.
Robin and I.
We want to find rewards that are more rewarding. What feels better? But often we're so conditioned to think about the letting go as, oh, I'm giving something up. So it feels like a struggle. But when we can feel into the rewards that are more rewarding, the letting go can be somewhere between effortless and less of a struggle. So then we're not fighting with ourselves. It comes from a more a natural, organic place, a knowing of, oh, this feels better. So in the same way, we want to deepen our embodied experience of results of the unwholesome, we can also deepen our embodied experience of the wholesome. How does it feel to maybe get up on time? How does it feel when I'm off, when I get off of Facebook after 5 or 10 minutes? How does it feel when I refrain from, sending that reactive email? Not just I shouldn't do it, it's not the right thing to do. But how does it feel in the body, in the heart? So what reward-based learning tells us is the brain has the ability to compare values. And when it finds something that's of better value, it can recalibrate. There's even a place in the brain where this happens. It's late for me. I don't remember the name of the name of the part of the brain. But if you want it, you can email me afterwards. And this is reward-based learning. This is how we hack the brain and tap into the natural way of learning. So we kind of bypass that the part where there's struggle, the part where there's judgment of ourselves. But again, coming back to the quote by Joseph Goldstein, it takes repetition. It takes repetition. The way I like to think about it is that we're building memory. And any time that we're aware of a habit loop is moving us forward. Because for me, at least, it's a world of difference when I'm like mindlessly eating chips, watching TV, right? Almost to the bottom of the bag, right? There's a world of difference between that mindlessness and being aware that, oh, this is what I'm doing right now. Am I tasting it? How does it feel? So as soon as we bring awareness to it, that starts building the memory. And once we're aware, we can shift into that second piece where we're asking, what am I getting? How is it feeling? I don't have to stop right now, but what I want to do is I want to log that data, record that data so the brain can take it in and build this disenchantment. So from this perspective, it's all workable. And even my mishaps, if you want to call that, even my slip-ups into my habitual behavior, if I'm logging it, I could still learn from it. So we can bow to these experiences, teachers, to help us move forward. Because I don't know anybody in my life and experience that's gotten rid of all their habits. I mean, sometimes they're strong and sometimes they're very, very mild, but they show up. And when they do, it's an opportunity to work with them.